The first on page one, famous statement of V'chol Amar Belisaper Bitziat Mitzrayim Hare Zem Mishubach. This comes from a Haggadah called Yalkut Lekachtov. Not someone in particular, basically someone piled different ideas from different Rabbanim. And this is an idea based from Rav Levenstein. And Rav Levenstein writes that this is like almost an introduction to the entire night of Pesach. We're about to read the story of the five rabbis who came together on B'nai Barak. And this line, Chol Amar B'Lesaper B'Tziyad Mitzrayim Harezim Mishubach, is the line right before the story. And he wonders, what's the significance and is there any reason in the juxtaposition, the Smichut HaParshiyot, as Rashi would say on the Torah, the juxtaposition between that piece and the story of the five rabbis. And he goes on to write, and I'm going to read from the second paragraph, V'Nireh L'Farish. ונראה לפרש שרצונו לומר שאפילו החכם והנבון שיכול בזמן שהוא מקדיש לסיפור יציאת מצרים לעסוק במעשה מרכבה. He says that the intellectual one, the smart people in the audience, we're going to say, everyone knows the story. Why would I want to deal with the story and about matzah? You know, let me read something more heavy duty. Let me try to understand more as to the difference between three matzot and two matzot. And what happens if someone eats a kazayin? Right, try to get more halachic topics. Or someone wants to look at things more in a in-depth intellectual way. But why should I deal with such a story? And he goes on to write, Gam kein mitzvah lasuk bisupu hapashut shel yitziyah mitzayim. Sometimes it's the simplicity of the story. It's a simple story. Some don't like to hear stories. Stories are fluff, right? What do I want to hear? I want to hear something very intellectual, something that's meaningful. But sometimes a simple story itself, the imagination of a story, can make us think of other things as well. You know, I have a child who says, I have a story to tell. And you just think about their imagination. They go from one character to another, from one scene to another scene. But you see where the child is coming from. And you see a little bit as to their imagination and the way they view the world. And a story could do that. A story could give us an in-depth understanding of a situation without actually explicitly telling us this is the way it is. This is the way one should understand it. And if anyone was at my shiur on Shabbat when we spoke about Chag Gadya, a little bit about the origins of Chag Gadya and the purpose of Chag Gadya. So towards the end of this year, we explained that the reason why Chag Gadya is esoteric, no one really knows what it's talking about, what's the point of the lamb and the cat. All of that is because we should give our own interpretation into the story. Sounds like a child's story. And here we're able to give in our own explanation. We're able to understand it in our own way. And that's the beauty of the night of Pesach, to take a simple story of, yeah, we came out of Egypt, to bring it home, to make it something real, to use our imagination and to really expand upon that. And that is why V'chol Amar B'Lesaper B'Tziyat Mitzrayim Hare Zem Mishubach. You talk about it more and more, you add more characters to the story, more scenes, Rapunzel's there, and you have all these other characters in the story. It makes it more rich, and you're able to understand the story and the national story of the Jewish people for generations and centuries up until now. We're going to start with the story of Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua on page 2. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Chayu Misumi ben Nevar. This is one of my favorite parts of the entire Haggadah. A, because there really is a lot of intellectual depth to the story. If you look at the history behind the story and where it took place and the significance of B'nai Barak and the significance of these five Tanaim in the story, you read up about that, it's unbelievable just to see the background as to the entire story. So obviously I didn't give you a 20-page article that I read that I could have gave you copies and you could have read about that. So I took snippets, but from the Haggadot and not from journals. And this is from the Haggadah called The Night That Unites. This Haggadah, The Night That Unites, puts together Rav Kook, Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Karlbach into one Haggadah. It's the one that unites the intellectual, the storyteller, and the spiritual one in the middle, right? And this is actually a beautiful Haggadah. It was put out last year by Rabbi Goldscheider. He used to be the rabbi of Mount Kisco. He made Aliyah a couple of years ago, and he brought this beautiful Haggadah. I ordered this Haggadah last year, and it was sold out, but more was on its way. And I was hoping I would get it before. I ordered 3 weeks before Pesach. I actually had his niece in my class. I was begging her, can you get me a copy? I'll pay you double. I just wanted to get this in my hand. And I ordered it and actually came the day after Pesach, during Chol HaMoed. It came during Chol HaMoed. So I actually didn't crack it open and see what was there, but this year I had a chance to take a look at it. Very, very beautiful ideas. So here, he quotes Rav Kook. And why we study to get Torah as a group. Now, Rav Kook was wondering, what's the point of these five rabbis coming together and studying the story of Pesach? What significance does that have? And he writes that the Talmud teaches that studying Torah in the company of others is ideal. And in general, the concept of a chavruta, of being able to work with another person, bouncing off your ideas. In school, this concept is very much now prevalent, not only in Jewish schools, but now in public schools, being able to share ideas in a group work, not just frontal teaching, but to hear it from other people, to hear ideas from other people. And so here, Rav Kook says, the ideal is to learn with someone else, or to learn in a group, and not to learn by yourself. And Rav Kook explains why, and this is the middle paragraph. An essential aspect of Torah scholars is the role they play in improving the world around them. To accomplish this, someone who studies Torah must develop an appreciation for opinions that differ with those of our own. Pretty hard to do that, huh? Whether in the realm of halacha, Jewish law, or in the realm of ethics. That kind of openness comes about only by means of group study. Right, if you learn in the yeshiva, that's very homogeneous. Everyone looks the same. Everyone talks the same. Everyone has the same havara. Everyone reads the Gemara the same way. Everyone davens the same way. Everyone buys their hat from the same place. Right? So you don't hear another voice. There might be another voice, and this is what I think the Rif says, and this is what the Rambam says. But at the end of the day, they're all coming from the same mindset, from the same yeshiva, from the same child and the same upbringing. But when you're in a group with other people, you're hearing different views, you see it in a different way from where that person grew up from, the community that they're from, the country that they're from, you start to see things in a different light. It is in this setting that one becomes accustomed to hearing ideas and opinions that are different from their own. The fact of being exposed to many approaches and perspectives produces a more accurate and enlightened understanding of the Torah. It's not just to be someone who's open-minded and knows the world more, but one will appreciate the Torah in different ways. We'll appreciate it. And the reason why it's so important that these five rabbis are here is because these five rabbis actually came from different parts of Israel. B'nai Brak was the city. Does anyone know who lived in B'nai Brak at the time? Huh? Rabbi Akiva. He was the chief rabbi of B'nai Brak. He was not the Nasi. He was not the president, the prince, the one who was appointed by the Jewish people. That was Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. Right, so he was the Nasi. To think about it, you're going to have a meal. You're going to probably go to the prime minister. Prime minister is not coming to you, right? But here they're all coming to B'nai Brak, the city that Rabbi Akiva was the chief rabbi. Not only was he the rabbi there, he was the second to youngest amongst all these rabbis. Poor 80-year-old rabbi who had to travel to go to this new up-and-coming rabbi. I got to go to B'nai Brak because that's where everyone else is going. Right? Where the chutzpah, where's the honor that the 80-year-old deserves? But everyone's traveling to B'nai Brak. B'nai Brak is the place. They're all going there. And they all argue in the Talmud in different, really different extremes, to the point where sometimes it gets very heated, can get very nasty between the different opinions. They're all coming together for the common purpose of speaking out the story. Let's talk about the story of Egypt. How do you understand it? Wait, you think the Egyptians were okay, not as bad as I think? Well, let me tell you, up in the north, you know, we got some of these enemies up there. You should see the way they act to us. And I think the Egyptians act the same. Well, no, in the south, we're actually very good with our neighbors. You know, we have other issues that we have to deal with. But I think the Egyptians were like people in the south. And everyone comes from different parts of Israel. And they're coming together in the city of B'nai Brak. Now, why is this important? So let's take a look at source number 3. And this comes from a blog. Blog called TorahMusings.com. By Gil's student. He has an excellent blog. And I think this was from 2005, maybe. He gives a little bit of the history and the importance as to the city of B'nai Brak and Rabbi Akiva. The reason why I brought this was because concise and short to the point. Again, there are articles, there are journals about it. There are lots of articles about the city of B'nai Brak and Rabbi Akiva. So I just want to give you a snippet. If anyone would like, you can email me. I'm happy to try to get a hold of it and make a copy and send one over. So he writes here that, and this is so interesting because it's based on the different statements that these rabbis made in all of the Talmud. Rabbi in Sukkah 27b, tells the story of Rabbi Eliezer chastising his student Rabbi Eli for visiting his mentor on the holiday. Rabbi Eliezer was of the view that part of the biblical mitzvah of enjoying the holiday is remaining in one's house. right? You get to stay home. You don't travel to a family member, right? Usually you stay in your home because it's so much easier to do that. And then parentheses, unless you're going to Florida on vacation, that's probably easier, right? He said, I praise the lazy who do not leave their houses on the holiday. Now here comes the interesting question that Rav Tzvi Hirsch, it's pronounced Chayas, the Maritz Chayit, writes that, why does Agada tell of a time during which Rabbi Eliezer spent the Passover Seder in Bnei Brak? Rabbi Eliezer, you just told your student, don't travel on the holiday. Hello, you just traveled to Bnei Brak on the holiday. What's this all about? Why would you do that? Should he not have felt obligated to remain in his house in Lod? He lived in Lod. Okay, Lod and Bnei Brak are not that far from each other, but still, why didn't he just stay in Lod? So Rechiel Michal Epstein, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, asks this question in his commentary to the Gada and points to the Gemara at the very end of Makot. Very famous story at the end of Makot, where, and he doesn't explain the passage, but the passage is where Rabbi Akiva was walking with Rabbi Yoshua and other rabbis, and they were by the ruins of the temple, the ruins of the Beit HaMikdash, and they're all crying and crying and crying because they saw a fox run through the ruins of the temple, and Rabbi Akiva is laughing. And they're all wondering, like, you got to be out of your mind. Why are you laughing? This is the saddest thing. The fox has just ran through the Holy of Holies, the place that the Kohen Gadol could go once a year, and sometimes when I even make it out alive. And here you got animals just running through. How could you not cry? And Rabbi Akiva says, well, if I know that the prophecy that the Beit HaMikdash would be destroyed came true, then I know the following prophecy, that one day, once again, old people and young people are going to be in the city of Yerushalayim and they'll populate the city of Yerushalayim. I know that's going to come true. So I'm laughing because I know one day it will come. So Rabbi Akiva was that optimist. He was the one who was able to see the cup half full. And so because he was the optimist, they all came to Rabbi Akiva for encouragement, for inspiration, to remind them of the inevitable redemption. We need some chizuk. Yes, I live in Lod. I told my student, don't go out of your home. But you know what? I'm sad. I'm depressed. With the Bar Kokhba revolt just happened. We've lost thousands of Jews. The Beit HaMikdash was just destroyed. I need some chizuk. And all these rabbis said, forget it. I'm putting my ego aside. I'm the Nasi. Rabbi Akiva, I'm coming to you. I told my students never to leave their home. You know what? This one exception, I'm going to leave my home. I'm the oldest. They should all come to me. I'm putting that aside. We are all going to Rabbi Akiva. Because Rabbi Akiva is that the one that can inspire. He's that optimist. And so this communal Seder, and the purpose for the Seder in the Haggadah is to teach us that the sages discuss the redemption, they discuss the story, but how important it is also to have it in a group setting. To be able to express one's feelings. I'm scared. Rabbi Akiva, I'm scared. What should I do? No, Rabbi Akiva, I'm 80 years old. I've seen this. I've never thought this would happen in my lifetime. Rabbi Akiva, what do we do now? You know, what do you think is going to happen in 30 years? How are my kids going to survive in this country? Are my grandchildren ever going to see the Beit HaMikdash once again? And Rabbi Akiva had to give them that chizuk, and he had to be that optimist. He was the one who had to do that. And and you could look at the bottom. You see the Rav Shlomo Karlbach in source number and page number 3 on the bottom also has a little bit of a similar idea. And the last paragraph, he says that they sat together. It says in the Haggadah until the students came. Rav Shlomo teaches these students represent our children. They are your children. They are my children. They are all our children. And our children are coming to tell us that they have received the message. The sun is coming up in just a little while. Redemption will be here. The students came back to all these rabbis and said, Rabbis, it's over. Kriyat Shema, the daytime. You got to go to shul. Stop talking about the story. And so they were coming to the rabbi and saying, the redemption is here. We think we see the sun. We think we finally see Medinat Yisrael. We see that we're able to come back to our home. We're getting there. We're getting closer and closer. The redemption is near. We feel it. And you could just imagine the survivors of the Holocaust never think of this, but their children and their grandchildren are able to feel it, able to see it. And so this inspiration that they needed from Rabbi Akiva, and the students were saying, you know, Rabbi Akiva, you've inspired us all. Just imagine the scene. Now think about it. If our rabbis are sitting around, the students are probably by the windows trying to peek in, trying to see what's happening in there. Right, what's going on? All these rabbis are there. They're not coming out of their homes. Let's see what happens. It reminds me when I was in yeshiva. I was by a rabbi by the name of Rav Baruch Mordechai Ezrachi. Baruch Mordechai Ezrachi is a Rosh Yeshiva of Ateret something or another. fill in the blank. I think it was Ateret Torah. I think it was Ateret Torah. And every year, the month of Elul, right, the first few weeks when they would come to yeshiva, he would have a Friday night tish in his home, and he would give like a fiery muster shmooze about Elul. And you got to remember, there's all students, and there's all talmidim of the yeshiva. And I was with Rav Goldvich's son, Eliada Goldvich, and we were there together because he was very close to Rav Meir Goldvich, Rosh Yeshiva of YU. So I'm friends with Eliada, and Eliada says, do you want to come with me? So we walked from the old city to Beit Vagan. It was around a two-hour walk or so. We walked there, and I said, sure. We ate there Friday night, and, well, we couldn't leave yet. We had to wait for the tish, but we're sticking around for 2 hours until this is happening. So the Rebbetzin tells us, stay right here. You would want to sit right here. It's prime seats. I'm like, okay, we're waiting. All of a sudden, room fills more and more. It's a tiny apartment. It's a tiny place. And as this tish is happening, I look outside the window. I'm like, oh my goodness. There are literally people hanging through trying to hear what's happening. Like, and I'm like, this is crazy. This is unbelievable. I'm here, VIP seats, and these guys are trying to get in and trying to hear what the rabbi has to say, the Musa Shmuz. And just imagine the scene where five rabbis are sitting together. Five major rabbis, the presidents of five major countries, are in a room that you could hear. You could stick your head in the room and see what's happening. It's an unbelievable scene to think about that. And so they were all trying to get that inspiration. People ran away from Yerushalayim. The people living in Bnei Brak. We all need that inspiration. It was Rabbi Akiva who was able to give them that inspiration. Let's go to page number four. I'm going to skip a few sources. You could read it on your own. Most of them are in English. So I just want to try to get through some of the ideas. And this is the Haggadah of the chief rabbi. There is only one chief Lord Rabbi, and that is Lord Jonathan Sacks himself. And this is from his Haggadah. Page four. The second source of page four says Haggadah of the chief rabbi. So he brings a halachic idea into this story. You know, there's always... In Gemara, it always says, you know, a rabbi could come get up and give a shiur, and the students come back home, and their friends ask them, so what did the rabbi say? What's the final halacha? You sat there for 2 hours, you know, in one line, what could you tell me? Yeah, you know what? After 2 hours, the rabbi wasn't sure what the final outcome was. But at the end of the day, do you drink four cups or do you drink three cups? Do you drink five cups or not? What do we do on the night of Pesach? Yeah, you know, he wasn't sure. Four is Gematria Dalit, three Gematria Gimel. He's trying to figure it out. He said, come back next week. So we're not sure. But there's a concept in halacha called Ma'aseh Rav. And that is, when you see a rabbi in the Gemara doing something, you could rest assured that you could follow what that rabbi is doing. Right, the rabbi says, you know, on Pesach you're not allowed to eat kidney, and then he sees him eating kidney, something's a little wrong there, right? Then you could assume, well, if he's doing it, I could do it also. Most of the time, you could assume that. You should probably ask him, well, what's going on over here? But for the most of the time, when there's a ma'aseh, when there is an action, when there's a story, something that you could see, that is holds more ground than just a shir that they hear. So he writes that this Haggadah, that there is a ma'aseh rav. It's more than just v'chol amar be'arezim mishuvach. Yeah, whoever speaks about the story of Pesach, it's a great thing, and you're praiseworthy, and you're such a tzaddik, an amazing person. This is actually, you see, people did it. It's not like something nice that they wrote in the Gemara. You should do that. Here you see five rabbis coming together, and they did it. It's something to learn about and to see that we also should do it. It happened once, and we should do it as well. And that is where the story comes into play. Okay. So that's the section of the story of the five rabbis. Any questions up until now? Anyone has something to add on? Don't be shy. I could pause the recording. Huh? All right. The Rasha. So if you look at the cover, I mentioned this last week, but let's take a look at our four sons over here. So you have the Chacham on the top right corner. Right, it's got a short beard. I don't think a longer beard, but he has a little bit of a short beard. It's got some nice paste on the side. It's got tzitzit. All right, looks like a chacham to me. The Rasha right next to him. Obviously, he needs to be smoking a pipe or something, because otherwise, how would you? He's holding some kind of a whip or a cane, huh? What? All right, so I guess Rashaim. Yeah, well, we will. I think we will all agree there is no second opinion. Yes. Nazis are Rishon. The one on the right bottom is the Tam. Now, I thought that maybe he was the Tzaddik, but the Chacham. But it looks like if you're I don't know if you're bigger than your tama. Again, I'm not sure the reason behind this story. This, and then you got the she'enu de'alusho, the macho man himself. You know, the guy doesn't know much, but he works out a lot, and he all right tries to stay fit. Not again. I'm not really sure. The Rush. Okay, whatever. So these are the four. And if you look at many Haggadot, the Rush is usually the villain. He's the devil. He's a mean guy. He's the one who doesn't care about Torah. He's the one who doesn't care about tradition. And so let's try to understand the Rush a little bit more. We're back to the night that unites Haggadah. Page five. So last week, I don't think we got a little Chassidish last week. We're going to a little Chassidish this week. I'm trying to flavor for everything here, for everyone. Whenever Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev came to the passage in the Haggadah of Passover, which deals with four children, he would always say when he came to the fourth son, the one who does not know how to ask, that one, the one who does not know how to ask, is myself. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. I do not know how to ask, Lord of the world, and even if I did know, I cannot bear to do it. How can I venture to ask you? Everything happens as it does. Why are we driven from one exile to another? So he spins it a little bit. He says, I don't know how to ask questions, meaning I don't know, God, should I ask why are we in exile? Should I question the reasons behind why good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? God, should I question why we are in exile? God, should I question why thousands and millions of people are killed? God, I'm not sure. I'm a she'eino yodei alisho. I'm not sure if I should be asking these questions. Why are foes allowed to torment us as they do? But then Haggadah, the father of the one who does not know how to ask, is told, is for you to disclose it to him. And the Lord of the world, I am I not your son? God, if I am your son, you are my father. So I might not ask the question. But you need to tell me a little bit. You need to give me the answers. You need to show me a glimpse as to why does all of this happen. I do not beg you to reveal the secrets. I don't want the secrets themselves. I cannot bear it. But please show me one thing. Show it to me more clearly and more deeply. Show me this, what is happening at this very moment. What does it mean to me? What is the demand of me? What are you, Lord of the world, telling me? Ah, what I wish to know is not why I suffer, but only whether I suffer for your sake. What he says here is, I don't necessarily want to know why am I suffering, but I want to know for what purpose does it have to do for you, God, that I'm suffering. Everything in the world is about God. It's not just about me. So God, if I am suffering, please tell me in the world, what is this for you? What is this in your greater scheme of things, in the greater picture of things? Please tell me that at least. And the purpose of what Yitzchak Berdichev is saying is a very important concept. It sounds very Hasidish and very cute, but the concept is so important, and that is, God, the purpose of the, why am I here in the for the purpose? What do you need from me? Right? Is it my tzedakah? And the millions of people can give tzedakah. Is it because you want me to bring children in this world? What is my purpose in this world? And that's really the question that essentially we should be asking our entire life. God, what is it you want from me? Is it to help people? Because I can help people? If that's the case, how do I do that more? God, is it because you want me to teach people Torah? Then how do I do that more? Is it because you want me to be able to be an inspiration, a model for others? Then how do I do that? God, teach me and tell me. Tell me how to be able to get that message out there. The Pirkei Avot writes, "Bechol yom vayom, bat kol yotzetz v'omera." Every day there's a bat kol that screams out and calls out a person's name. And the obvious question is, well, I don't hear it. I just don't hear that. I don't hear Batko screaming out my name. I don't hear Batko telling me what I should be doing. So the way the Sfarim, the Hasidim love to explain that, it's there every single day, but it's like a radio. Oh, they didn't have a radio then. But it's like modern day, like a radio. If you want to hit the 10-10 wins, you got to get to 10-10 wins. Not 10, 1,000, not 10-20, not 10-30. 10-10, it's a radio. You got to tune in exactly to that radio station to be able to hear the radio. So too, God calls out our name every day. He's trying to send us a message. So we don't hear it because we're obviously not on that level, on the spiritual level. But we need to be able to tune ourselves a little more and try to open up our eyes, hear the messages, see the miracles in our own day, see our miracles in our lives, and to try to bring that home and to see, okay, God, I got the point. I think I see what you're trying to tell me here. Okay, now what do I do with that? Now I need a little more. Now I need a little bit more help. And that is what he says when it comes to the Tam. The She'enu Yodei Alisho. That we need to, at Petachlo, we need to encourage that child. The child who doesn't ask questions, to encourage him and say, Hey, what do you want to do in your life? Oh, you want to be a doctor? Why do you want to be a doctor? Oh, and to try to see, and how does that play to help the world? How does it help the Jewish people? How does it help yourself? How does it help your family? And you could fit that almost with any profession to see, okay, that's, you want to make money? Beautiful. It's a good thing. What do you want to do with that money? You want to be able to build institutions, or you just want to go to, well, on vacation 3 times a year? It could be that's what the person wants to do. But how does that help the world? How does it help the people? How does it help the family? Okay. Beriskin, and this is actually an idea that I saw from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who lived before Beriskin, so I'm assuming it probably came from that. I try to find the original text. I remember seeing it years ago. I wasn't able to find it. But this is a concept, and I think this is a very famous concept that many of us probably have heard, that, you know, we always look down on the Russia, say how terrible that child is, but at the end of the day, the child is there. The child is there at the Seder table. Unfortunately, there's a child who doesn't show up to the Seder table. That's the one that we're losing. Now, the Russia, you could deal with questions, and they want to question, they should be able to question. But that child, the family member, the cousin, the whoever it may be, the sibling, that doesn't show up to the Pesach Seder, that's the one that we're losing. That's the one that's more heartbreaking and heart-wrenching than just the Russia himself. And so that's something to keep in mind, because you know, the wicked child is not as bad as we think that child is. And who more than the Karl Bach himself to be able to spin things and to make it seem positive, and how positive this child is. But this time he actually quotes the Belzer Rebbe. Also, he quotes the Belzer Rebbe, and I thought this is very, very unique. Obviously, a little bit of a Hasidish idea, but I enjoyed this idea. So he says, and it's cut off on the top. But let me tell you about the four children. Some children are good, some are the best, some are clever, some are not so clever. Seder night gives me a taste of how much God believes in all of them. Sometimes you see young people, and they are a little off. Okay, you know. You know why they're off? Because there wasn't anybody to believe in them. It's so easy to get off the highway when nobody believes in you. Pause for a second. This is, you know, it sounds cute, but it's so true. I mean, being teaching in a school, so being able to see past students who are in high school now, and you're able to speak to them, and they say, you know, I just want to tell you, I'm not here to boast. It's only happened once, so don't think it's happened, you know, many times, okay? But that the student comes back and says, I want you to know because you believed in me, you know, it kept me going. Kept me going. I wasn't the best student. I wasn't the nicest person, and I gave you a lot of Gehenna. But you believed in me, and that belief that you had in me really carried me on. And it really is very important to believe, and it's hard to do. It's hard to see that. Believe me. You come home and you're like, I wish he wasn't in my class, because you know it's hard. It's hard having it. But the belief itself. The belief is really able to inspire. So he says, they weren't able to believe in. Our holy rabbis teach us that the chacham, the clever boy, is very beautiful. As long as you think that being clever is everything. The chacham is intellectual. He needs to be taught. How about stopping being only intellectual? How about tasting the afikomi, tasting the depth of life, feeling deep emotion, serving God with it? The clever person isn't far away from the wicked person. What do you think the wicked child is? Someone who was never told how holy he is. And this is so true if you think about it. What's the opposite of a Rasha? A Tzaddik. So why isn't it Tzaddik, Rasha, Tam She'en Yodea Lishon? What Chacham? Why Chacham and Rasha? Opposite of a Rasha is a Tzaddik. Because I think what the Baal HaGad is teaching us here, these are all children. Things could change, right? Children change over time. Yeah, you have this inspired eighth grader who loves learning Torah, but you know what? When he gets into high school, meets the wrong friends, is told that, you know, you're not as clever as you thought you were in eighth grade, things start to go sour, and that chacham continues to stay a chacham his entire life. He is smart, he's intellectual, but he's not a tzaddik. He might not be a tzaddik. These are children, raw material. Now what happens? Yeah, this one seems to you like a Rasha? Okay, do something with him. Change him into a tzaddik. The chacham is a smart tzaddik. Make him into a tzaddik. The she'eino yodea lishol, who doesn't know how to ask a question, all right, give him some port. Scaffold. Help him out a bit. Okay, now make him into a tzaddik. The tam? The tam might not know much. It might be quiet. Maybe nobody believed in him. Maybe nobody asked him. So what do you think? Tommy the tam, what do you think? Right? What do you think is the story here? What do you think the Haggadah is trying to teach us? Nobody gave that chance for that child. And so all of these four children could become tzaddikim. They could all become tzaddikim. The Rasha could become a tzaddik. But you have to do something with them. And sometimes with the Rasha, you got to be a little stern. You got to be a little strong. With the Chacham, you got to increase intellectual and maybe bring some emotion into it. The Tam, you got to... All of these are children. You have to do them. Which is why the Abra Banim and not, you know, not Abra Anashim. It's Abra Banim. They're children. They're raw material. And he goes on to say, here's the most beautiful Belzer Torah. The Agada says, when you talk to the wicked son, what should you do? Blunt his teeth. This always like, come on. Blunt it to, not only are you going to blunt his teeth, then it's going to cost you money. You got to take him to the dentist after. I mean, what's the point of doing that? Right? When someone's angry, they, oh, I broke it. I can't believe I did it. I can't believe I did that. So it's a little heartbreaking. He came to the Seder after all. He didn't have to come at all. That I'm here because you asked me to come because the family is here. I'm here. But don't ask me anything. Don't tell me how much a kazayit is. I don't care, right? I'm going to taste the matzah. Don't tell me I didn't lean and I got to lean again and drink it. I'm not doing any of that. I'm doing a little bit, the bare minimum, just because that's what the family wants me to do. Now the word Russia, wicked, is made up of three letters. Outside are Resh and Ayin, thank you, making Ra bad. But the inside letter is the Shin. And what does that mean? The three lines that make up a Shin symbolize Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. If the Shin with its three lines is in the middle of the Rasha, that's to tell you that every Jew in the world is connected to their forefathers. There is a source of the forefathers are there. His insight, his neshama, is connected to them. So we tell the father, blunt his teeth. Shinav. The word shinav, teeth, is from the letter Shin. Shinav, like the Shin. If you want to educate the boy, knock his Shin loose from the rest of him. You know, take out the middle part of him. Take out the neshama. Take the part of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Bring out his inner nature that's connected with the fathers. Give him courage. Tell him not to make you think that he's not holy, because you know that he really is holy. He's got to take that out. Bring that holiness out of him. Leave the ra out there. Leave all the bad you could from today to tomorrow say, you know, I stayed up for you till 3 o'clock in the morning. You do this every Saturday night. You don't even realize my hair is gray and I'm only 42 and it's all because of you. All right. You know, yes, to be able to have that talk, to talk with them. But also, bring that out. Bring that, and it's so difficult. Listen, I don't have teenagers. I'm not at all here to preach anyone. Not at all. But I'm just reading what it says. I'm trying to give a little bit of an explanation. But to be able to bring that out, you know, they once asked, I think it was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. They once asked him, you know, you're lucky because you know your children are from, they're religious. Look at many rabbis, many Rashi yeshiva from the right to the left, and you always have, you know, the black sheep or a few children who are not religious. This one went off this derech, this one went off the derech. Let's read history. Talk about even the last 20, 30 years. Massive, big rabbis. So they asked him, how did you keep your children religious? What happened there? He said, you want to know? I just davened. I just davened. I can't control them. Every day I daven, God, please keep my children on the path. Help me keep them on the path. They decide they have the wrong friends. They decide to do the wrong things. There's so much I could do. There's so much I'm able to do. So the tefillah is a part of it, and be able to bring out the goodness, to bring out the Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov in them, the neshama, and to remove the ra, all the negative things that one could think of them, and to only see the great things that are there with them. So that's the positive way of looking at the Rasha. You got to give a little bit of the negative just because the Rasha. So just a few sources of the Rasha. So this is from the Haggadah of the Hasidic masters. To be honest, I did not think tonight was going to be a lot of Hasidic. That was not my intention at all. But I figured let's try to give a little bit of a flavor of different Haggadot, different than what we saw last week. So Rav Naftali Tzvi Rupshitz was asked why new Haggadot are printed year in and year out. So my answer to that is because printing presses need to make more money, right? If you think about it, the Haggadah of so-and-so, Rabbi so-and-so, is just a collection of like different writings of his books that just put together in Haggadah. It's not like he wrote a parish on the Haggadah. And this happens with every single year. It's like all of a sudden, the Rabbi died 50 years ago. How did he come out with Haggadah all of a sudden? Nobody found his Haggadah? All right, it's because they collected things and the printing press realized, let's make money off of it and we'll do it. So he writes, why are there new Haggadahs every year? So it says, the wicked son of last year replied, seems to be a righteous man this year in the light of the rapid decline of the generations. It's very sad. It's really very sad. Because every generation has their interpretation of the wicked son. And then years later, they're like, you know what? I prefer to have that wicked son than the wicked children we have now. And I prefer to have the one who would come to shul, but yet, you know what, would do other things that I would be very upset, and the child doesn't come to shul at all and does all those bad things. And I prefer to have the child who still feels like he's part of the family and wants to be connected and wants to come to me for sukkah and wants to come to me for Pesach than the child who says, you know, I got work over sukkah, I can't come by, but you know, maybe I'll stop by on a Sunday afternoon. That's very hurtful. That's very different than in every generation that has their own challenges. And so every year, the wicked son is seemed to be someone else, and of a different definition to them. Okay, we're going to skip the Sfat Emet. Again, it's in English. You could read that. It gives a little bit of a definition as to what Russia was trying to say. Okay. Pages 7, 8, and 9 are from a beautiful Haggadah. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lapp, he was the chief rabbi of Israel. He is currently the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. His son, Rav David Lau, is the current chief rabbi of Israel. And he is a Holocaust survivor. If any of you read the book, Out of the Depths, right? So that's about his life and his story. And so he has a beautiful parish on Pirkei Avot. That's in Hebrew and in English. I highly recommend it. And also, he has a Haggadah that's, I'm not sure if they have it in English. They have it in Hebrew. This is like the full version. And then they have another version that's supposed to be for like the more secular Israelis, where it's supposed to not look so heavy and so thick. It's edited a bit, shortened. The ideas are there. The more ideas that they would be able to, you know, feel like they could take home. So there, you could find two different Haggadot like that. This is the more expanded version. And so this is a Haggadah that he wrote, and I thought there were two very beautiful ideas on this Haggadah. Lots of ideas, but definitely these two. So he writes that when it comes to the difference between Paro and Lavan, right? We speak about Lavan, what did Lavan wanted to do? Batzala korat hakol. He wanted to uproot everything, and you know, reading the Torah, the Psukim, Lavan doesn't seem to be such a terrible... I mean, yeah, he's a bad guy, but Paro or Lavan, which one's worse? Family Feud, I think 99 would say out of 100 that Paro is worse than Lavan, right? Probably Paro's worse than Lavan, except that one guy who's related to Paro would say Lavan. Right? Other than that, you're going to get 99 of people that are going to say Paro was worse than Lavan. So why are we saying that Lavan, Ratzalah Kortak, we wanted to uproot everything? Everything. He wanted to destroy everything. And how could that be? So he asked, and it's a famous question, and he asked that question. And then he writes, well, you might say, well, the difference between Paro and Lavan was that Paro wanted to destroy us physically. He wanted to make us work as slaves. But Lavan was more physical, spiritual. He wanted to destroy us beruach and by... and by our spirituality. So there he says, nah, that's not also true. Because Lavan really cared about his idols more than the spirituality, more than Yaakov's children. Remember, when he came, he wondered, Lama ganafta et Elohai? Why, Rivka, who, Yaakov, why did you steal my God? Nothing about, like, why did you guys run away from me? Like, hey, I miss my grandchildren, let's bring them back here. Wait, where are my idols? And like you see, like the probably Reuven, Saba, move away, where are my idols? Right? He cared more about his idols. So if that was the case, then what was so bad about Lavan? How did he want to destroy us? So he writes in the 1, 2, 3, the paragraph says, Edim Anu. It says, Edim Anu Bidorot Rabim. We are witness to many generations, Umabiha Bidor Acharon. And especially the last generation, the tfuashe amenu pochet veholech bechol artzot hanikar. Unfortunately, and he says that we are becoming less and less in many countries. The number of Jews are becoming less. Bemechkar statisti bebarur mitgale ki miben meabeshishim amedinot behen yeshnam yudim mispar ze o acher hare beeser hashanim achonor rak b'shtaymen ala mispar yehudim. Says, let's take roughly 160 countries in the world. The past 10 years, statistically, that the number of Jews have declined in those countries, other than two, and who could think of, well, one, Israel, who could think of the other one? Who knows the other one? It's actually statistically correct. It's pretty scary. Germany. Germany is the fastest growing Jewish community outside of Israel. And the reason for that is a lot of...
If you start with zero,
you're right. Probably it's true. Unfortunately, it's probably true, right? But a lot of Russian Jews are moving to Germany. And there are a lot of European Jews who are also moving to Germany more and more. They probably think, well, if they got it wrong the first time, they're not going to get it wrong the second time. But I don't know. We'll see. I mean, that's what a lot of people think. You know, Germany is behind us. But I don't know. We'll see what happens. And so he writes that statistically, these are the only two countries. And so he writes, obviously, what's the problem here? Why are numbers declining? It's not because there are pogroms and Jews are being murdered and killed. It's because of hitbolilut, of assimilation. And he writes that this assimilation is worse, is much worse than any other form of decline. It's much worse than killing, God forbid, 1,000 Jews here and a few hundred here. The hitbolilut is so great, the numbers are so great of intermarriage, that we are losing more and more Jews to that. And he says that's what Lavan tried to do. Paro wanted to kill us physically or to make us work. So that was more of our bodies. But Lavan was canine. He was lying. He tried to figure out ways to get us to worship Avodah Zarah, to try to get us to do other things more than just our back-breaking work. And so that's much worse. The Hitbolilut is much worse over time. And that is something that is why we view Lavan at much worse, in a much worse light than Paro himself. Okay. Go with the last of our Torah. Okay, so he writes here a famous midrash that why were the Jews saved from Mitzrayim? So he says because they didn't change their name, they didn't change their language, they stayed away from any illicit relations, and they didn't change they didn't say Lashon Hara. That's what the midrash says. And he goes on to show why that's very important. And he says the common theme, the common denominator of all of this is a concept of achdut, and that is of unity. The language unites people. Right? You feel comfortable, at least I feel comfortable, when I'm walking in the middle of a mall, let's say in Livingston, Washington, and I hear an Israeli talking to another Israeli in Hebrew, thinking that, you know, who might know what I'm saying, you know, and I hear them, and I feel like, I'm not so far away from Jewish life. You know, I hear an Israeli talking. Or when you're walking somewhere and you know the person selling that the minerals and the cream, you know they're Israeli, you feel like, you know, all right, you know, they're stopping me because they know I'm Jewish. Hello, hello, one second, come here, please. You know, you speak Hebrew? Well, yeah, I think I do, you know. And so you feel good about that. There's something that you feel. So the language itself, the language is what brings people together. The names, you know, names mostly bring people together. You know, you're at the doctor's office and you hear Chaim, looking for Chaim, right? So you thought, oh, there's another Yid here, there's another Jew, Chaim, right? There's someone else that's here. Arayot, obviously, illicit relationships and adultery and all of that, be able to keep a family together, to be able to family unit together. And Lashon Hara, which could obviously destroy and to ruin relationships. I don't know if you know the famous story of the rabbi of a town. Somebody had something against the rabbi. It's not in West Orange. So someone had something against the rabbi, and it spread Lashon Hara. He said something terrible about the rabbi. And it got to the point where it came back to the rabbi, and he's like, I didn't do such a thing. I can't believe it. Who said this? And eventually, the person who said the Lashon Hara felt bad about it. And he went to the rabbi, and he said, Rabbi, you know, I want to apologize. You know, I really didn't like you. And you said some things that I disagreed with. But eventually, my friends and my wife knocked some sense into me and said, how could you destroy a person's career like that? I want to say I'm sorry. I'm the one behind this. So the rabbi said, you want to say you're sorry? Before you do so, I want you to do something, then I'll forgive you. He says, what should I do? He says, go to your home, take one of your feather pillows, and open it up and throw it in the streets. Okay? He says, okay? So he goes there, and he does it, and he comes back to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, I did it. You forgive me now. No, now what I want you to do is to go back and collect all the feathers and put them back into the pillowcase. So, Rabbi, it's impossible. The cars and the wind probably moved the feathers different places. The rain and I can't find every single feather. And he says, that's exactly what we did with my reputation. You took it, cut it up into many, many pieces. You threw it all over the community. And now you want to try to repair it and collect it all and bring back my reputation. It's never going to be the same. It's never going to be like that. So Lashon Hara could obviously destroy, Achdut could destroy a community. And he goes on to say that the importance of the night of Pesach is the concept of a family nucleus, of a family. We're coming together as a family. We're speaking to our children as a family. You invite people as a community. The importance of being able to tell over the story in any language that one understands. To be able to have that family unit. And he goes on to say, I'm not sure where he got this from, because I actually once said this in a drasha, and I don't remember where I got it from. But this last paragraph in source number 9. You know what? Actually, I think it was from his son. I got it from, now that I'm thinking about it. HaRayon hazeh ramuz gam b'divrei Moshe Rabbeinu. This is a beautiful, beautiful idea. He says this concept of being able to, the importance of a family unit, or importance of a people, we see from Moshe. Kesher hu ba lafri be Datan v'aviram anitzim. The story of Datan and Aviram. Right, two Hebrews fighting with one another, and they're screaming and they're yelling and they're fighting. Amer lo echad mehem, and Moshe and one of them says, "Al regeni ata umer, kasher harakta et hamitzri." Are you going to come and kill me? By the way, we know you killed that Egyptian yesterday. We know you killed the Egyptian and you buried that Egyptian. So what happens? Az magiv Moshe. Moshe responds and he says, "Achein noda davar." Now I know it's no. So when you read the pasuk, how do you interpret that pasuk? Uh-oh, like now it's known that I killed that Egyptian yesterday. I better start running because, you know, the Egyptian secret agents are going to come after me. But he says, "Hu eino mitkaven rak al pirsum oto maaseh sharagim." Not that, oh, now everyone knows what I did with that Egyptian. Ela be'etzem akol hashibu. Now I know why we are in exile. Now I know why we are servants to Paro. Omer Moshe betzar. Moshe says in pain, "Achein." Now I know what's been bothering me the entire time. Why is it the Jews are always suffering? If now I know that one of my own brothers, my own people, is going to rat me out to the government that I killed this Mitzri, who I was trying to save a Jewish person. Like, they were fighting, I was saving this Jewish servant. And this is what he's going to do. My own brother is going to do that to me. Now I know why this ever-long servitude that our people have. So when Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, it says, 70 nefesh. Right, 70 souls. So nefesh, not nefashim, but shivim nefesh, because they were one. They came down as achdut. However, things happened and there were fights between one another. Kfi shehaya gam b'ma'amar har Sinai of vayichan shehayam Yisrael neged har ki ish echad b'lev echad. The night of Pesach is to be able to bring back that achdut. It's to be able to include the Rasha. It's to include the Chacham. It's to include the Tam, include Sheini Yodeh Elisho. It's to include those that you might not be comfortable with. It's to include those that you are not such good friends or family members that I got to force to invite them. It's at that time that we have that Achdut to be able to come together. Then hopefully we're able to tell the story of Sipur Yitzia Mitzrayim. And once again, we hope and we pray to have the Geula Shelema in our days and be able to go back to Eretz Yisrael and not